Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, it's Potpourri number 8, featuring Mumia Abu-Jamal, The Fire Sign Theater, and commentary by yours truly. I hope you'll stay tuned. If you are hearing this in mid-2020, this is an all-new episode. One of the countless horrors inflicted on the citizens by big business and its army of marketing experts has been the degradation of every language. As you know, the Buddha himself said, "The first step out of perdition is to rectify the language," or whatever the Buddhist equivalent of perdition is. So it is with tongue in cheek that I announce this all-new episode. Of course, all-new episode means only new episode. The all is in fact factually incorrect. Both the theme music and the host have been repeated every week for 11 years. And technically, this is not an episode, but an installment. Any of your neighbors with a graduate degree in English will be glad to explain the difference. But we all live in a sea of euphemisms, half-truths, and lies. This is a world in which the Department of Defense has been spending close to $250 billion a year only to defend your life against imminent destruction by dozens of little third-world countries, including my favorite of our fiendish arch-enemies, Grenada. This is a world in which Lysol and hydroxychloroquine cure COVID-19, and the World Health Organization is but the shock troops of the international communist conspiracy. In such a world, what possible difference could one more all-new episode make? I must note also this. This all-new episode is the latest in our Potpourri series, Potpourri number 8. That means the installment is loosely organized, a collection of this and that, including a few interesting fragments from the cutting room floor, snipped out of earlier shows simply because time did not permit their airing. The unkind might call the show a hodgepodge. I prefer potpourri. Literally, a potpourri is a bunch of fragrant dried flowers and dried herbs. It was carried in one's pocket or hand as one traversed the city. Cities and large parts of the countryside stank in the 17th, 18th, and even early 19th century. There was no indoor plumbing. There were very few zoning laws, and the germ theory of disease was unknown, then not widely accepted, and last, too often ignored. A couple of centuries ago, in the cities, all human and animal excrement was dumped in the gutter, running down the center of the road. Offal from slaughterhouses and butcher shops and fishmongers also were dropped into the gutter. It stayed there in the gutter and decomposed further until a heavy rainstorm might wash it into some other neighborhood downhill. Edinburgh was famed for its stench, and London was not too far behind. Pandemics, including the bubonic plague, struck Europe several times. The bubonic plague itself hit London as recently as the mid-17th century. 1655 it was. So citizens employed a potpourri, not only to mask the stench of the city, but also to ward off, they hoped, a deadly pandemic that no one quite understood and no one could cure. Hey, does that sound just a little bit like us? Can you relate to that? Potpourri, the homemade cloth face masks of the 17th century. One quick further connection, the children's singing game Ring Around the Rosie is common all over the world. One child stands. Other children form a ring and dance and sing around the standing child. At the end of the song, everybody falls down and laughs. Lyrics vary considerably. Many folklorists believe the song likely refers to the plague. One common version of the lyrics begins, "Ring a ring of roses, a pocket full of roses." The most common American version goes, "Ring around the rosy, a pocket full of posy." In either case, the rosy or roses of the first line likely refers to the bright red blotches on the faces and bodies of people infected with bubonic plague. The pocket full of roses or pocket full of posy in the second line probably refers to a bundle of potpourri, which people came to realize will save you from illness and death about as well as your homemade cloth face mask will. But yes, I do think we should all wear one to help protect others. Back to the song. It's easy to see the meaning of ashes, ashes, we all fall down. There's an even more intriguing variant form found in numerous other countries. The poem ends, "Achoo, achoo, we all fall down." So, potpourri number 8, a show for our time. And guaranteed to be at least as effective as the original potpourri in curing the ills of our time. I will personally guarantee that in curing COVID-19, potpourri is every bit as effective as the Salk vaccine, Viagra, Lipitor, Taxol, and Lysol combined. And potpourri carries no risk of any side effects except maybe a little hay fever. Ask your doctor if potpourri is right for you. And please stay tuned while you're on hold. Thus ends my lecture. But enough from me. Let's hear from the Firesign Theater. The Firesign Theater, he continued, was a quartet of chaps who produced audio recordings of comic satire and enjoyable nonsense. They flourished in the late 1960s and the 1970s. They made fun of popular media, commercials, marketing, current fads, hack politicians, and the worst excesses of American politics and popular culture. Sort of like Mad Magazine for considerably hipper adults. Firesign's own politics was very hard to pin down, but like most satirists, they loved exposing propaganda and BS in general. In November 2019, we aired an installment called Thanksgiving Conquest Genocide. It featured historian Roseanne Dunbar Ortiz and a good sketch by Firesign Theater, both of which gave an alternative view of the interactions of the white settlers and North America's indigenous people, alternative to the BS they taught you in junior high school. I had to snip out the first 2 minutes of Firesign's sketch, which was about the Spanish conquest. Let's add this to our potpourri. Here is the unvarnished truth about the Spanish conquest.
Well, I think it's about time. The way the corn's been growing for the last two or three generations.
Look at that herd of buffalo. They're ready.
Everything's living the Great Spirit's way, in harmony.
He'll be here soon.
True white brothers coming home. Remember what the Great Spirit said? If we did what we were supposed to do and lived according to the plan, White Brother would finish his work in the East and come back to us. It'll be nice to have the family together again.
Buenos dias, amigo.
Hello, you must be the true White Brother.
Sure, you must be the Indian.
Yes.
Welcome home.
Welcome to New Spain. This is your new father, Father Corona.
Down on your knees now. Do you recognize what I'm holding over your heads, lads?
It's a cross, the symbol of the quartering of the universe into active and passive principles.
God have mercy on their heathen souls.
What the father means is, what is the cross made of? Gold. Have you got any?
No.
What about the seven cities of gold? Phoenix, Tucson, Las Vegas?
This is gold.
What's that?
Corn.
Hey, corn! Now we can make tortillas!
We've been waiting for this for hundreds of years.
I just invented tacos!
So this is all you got?
Yes, but aren't you the true White Brother who's supposed to come and live with us in peace?
Sure. Therefore, I claim this rich verdant of pasture land in the name of the Empire of Spain.
Hey, Capitano, the rain, she's a stop to fall, and the corn, she's all dead.
Shut up, Vespucci. I claim this stinking desert in the name of the Empire of Spain forever. Let's go.
God bless Vespucci land.
Oh, by the way, Domini, you're all Catholics now. God bless you.
Come on, and Father, nobody in their right minds would live in this stinking desert.
Come on, Cisco.
That was too short. Here's another fire sign routine on another subject dear to New World Notes' heart, establishment propaganda aimed at the average citizen. The sketch is a parody of the entertaining war propaganda that Hollywood churned out exclusively in the early 1940s and kept churning out for many years after VJ Day. Now, in the early summer, with Memorial Day following hard on the heels of Armed Forces Day, soon to be followed by D-Day anniversary and Flag Day, to say nothing of Independence Day, with every bloke who ever put on a uniform now always called a hero, in these days we need frequent reminders that we fish live in a sea of propaganda. Here is Firesign Scenes from a fictitious Hollywood epic, Babes in Khaki.
I'll see what I can do, Sergeant. Elaine?
Oh,
honey?
Maury, please don't come in now.
Why you got the lights off in here, baby? I gotta talk to you.
Maury.
Honey, look, this is serious. You gotta go out there and give yourself to those men.
I can't face those boys. Not now. Not yet.
Tomorrow ain't coming for a lot of those boys, Lurleen.
But, Maury, they're all wearing Bill's face.
Honey, we've all got up. Would you put that stuff down, please? What would Bill think? Excuse me, look, if it wasn't for those millions of boogies out there, the president of these United States would be named Schickelgruber. Baby, excuse me for saying it, but ever since Anzio, you've been acting like a spoil.
Oh, my goodness.
I'll get it.
Yes.
Telegram for you, Miss D'Angelo.
I'm sorry. I didn't know. This is for you, ma'am.
Thank you, son. Just a minute. Boy, come here.
Yes?
Where are you from?
Nairobi, ma'am. Isn't everybody?
This is for you.
Thank you, ma'am. Just want you to know all the boys we be waiting for you out there. God bless you, Miss Lolene.
Let me see that telegram, will you? Honey, that's from Washington, D.C.
Oh, Maury, my mascara is running. You read it for me.
All right. Sit down, Lurleen. This may be rough. Honey?
Yes?
The President of the United States is named Schickelgruber.
I'm going out there, Maury. Help me into this parachute.
No, honey. You can't go out there. It's too late.
Zip
I'm telling
me up.
You.
It's never too late, Maury. I'm going out there because I'm bringing the war back home.
All right, boys. All right. Quiet down now. Here's the ace. That lovely piece of cake we've all been waiting for. Miss Lily Lamont.
We're bringing the war back home. Where it ought to be.
like to express our appreciation to the United States Marines, the British Commonwealth Occupation Forces, the French Legume, and the Hong Kong Fireworks Company, without whom all of this would not have been necessary.
One final item, and no time for much introduction. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a journalist and radical black activist from Philadelphia. He was convicted of murdering a policeman in a trial that created, to put it mildly, much reasonable doubt of his guilt. He is now serving a life sentence in prison. In 2019, by telephone, he addressed students at Yale Law School on the subject Rebel Lawyers. It's a fascinating talk. Here it is.
Rebel Lawyers. Dear friends at Yale Law School, dear Rebel Lawyers, on the move, I greet you all as I endeavor to address the issue of Rebel Lawyers. When I think of the term, the first thing that comes to mind are jailhouse lawyers. They are, by definition, rebels who oppose the prison industrial complex, especially in the courts. Jailhouse lawyers fight for freedom for themselves and others, and sometimes they prevail. Some jailhouse lawyers, like John and Mo Africa of the Moo Organization, defended themselves at trial and won acquittals. Because such men and women aren't trained in the law and do their work using logic and sheer will, they fall under the description of rebel lawyers, I think. But I've got a feeling that this isn't what students at Yale Law think of when they use the term. If you're really interested in that subject, I urge you to see my book, Jailhouse Lawyers. Let us return to rebel lawyers, but with a peculiar twist. That's because I'm speaking here of two revolutionary leaders who went to law school but found that the law and the systems that they lived under were so corrupt, so biased, so dominated by unjust political elites that they learned that their very society had to be radically transformed before the law could be functional. I speak of two men who are rarely thought of as lawyers, even though both studied law, and one even briefly practiced it. I speak of Fidel Castro and Nelson Mandela. Castro went to law school under the Cuban dictatorship of Fulgencio Batista, a tool of U.S. imperialism and a supporter of the American mafia. Mandela earned his law degree under the racist National Party, which ruled South Africa with brutality and what they called apartheid, Afrikaans for separateness, a system of domestic colonialism that deprived all Africans of their most fundamental human rights. Both Castro and Mandela rebelled against such unjust systems and joined revolutionary movements to transform those societies. They are, therefore, the very epitome of rebel lawyers. But again, unless I'm dead wrong, I don't think there's a Fidel or a Nelson in this audience. But I'll be glad to be wrong. The next rebel lawyer is a little closer to the mark. He's Clarence Darrow, who lived during the late 19th and the early 20th centuries. He was a brilliant lawyer, a socialist, back when millions of Americans voted for socialists, and an atheist. In 1902, Darrow went to the Cook County Jail in Chicago and spoke to the prisoners there about law. Here's a little something of what he said. See what the law is. When these men, the rich, get control of things, they make the laws. They do not make the laws to protect anybody. Courts are not instruments of justice. When your case gets into court, it'll make little difference whether you are guilty or innocent, but it's better if you have a smart lawyer. And you cannot have a smart lawyer unless you have money. First and last, it's a question of money. Those people who own the earth make the laws to protect what they have. They fix up a sort of fence or pen around what they have, and they fix the law so the fellow on the outside cannot get in. The laws are really organized for the protection of the men who rule the world. They were never organized or enforced for justice. We have no system for doing justice, not the slightest in the world, unquote. Those are the words of Clarence Darrow, one of the original rebel lawyers. In September 1925, Dr. Ossian Sweet of Detroit was charged and convicted of murder after shooting at a mob of whites assembled to attack his home for being a black man who dared to move into a white area. When he was granted a retrial, Clarence Darrow took the defense case and won an acquittal. You, law students, should read the closing arguments, for you will read some of the finest arguments ever made in an American courtroom. I leave that to you if you're interested. Now, I use Darrow as a model for rebel lawyers for a reason. You, as law students, have a wealth of doors open before you. Indeed, some of you will go into prosecutors' offices and work to help build and strengthen the bulwark of mass incarceration. Why? Because the lure of power is powerful. How do you think mass incarceration came to be? Was it a mistake? No. Back during the early 1980s, neoliberals took power in major American cities and waged war on black communities, led more often than not by Democrats like Philadelphia's first black mayor, Wilson Good, who brought the infamous MOVE bombing into being. Shortly before him, D.A. Edward Rendell would join with former Mayor Frank Rizzo to give his blessing to the August 8, 1978 attack on MOVE. Several years later, Rendell would announce an end to the prevailing prison system by saying that prisons would no longer do rehabilitation. Their job, he said, was incapacitation. Thus, we saw the so-called drug war achieve hyperstatus, with neoliberals joining conservatives to enact mass incarceration on a scale the nation and world had never seen before. It should not, therefore, surprise us when we see that Pennsylvania had the highest number of juvenile lifers on earth. Bipartisanship between neoliberals and conservatives built the monster we now call mass incarceration. No so-called progressive prosecutor can or will unbuild it. That's because it took the entire system, DAs, judges, cops, defense lawyers, and prison administrators, not to mention the media, to collaborate on a monstrous project like mass incarceration. Only mass resistance can abolish mass incarceration. In other words, only a mass movement. Movements like Black Lives Matter, or, for that matter, Red Law, movements of law students who stay engaged after they become lawyers and say no to monsters like mass incarceration and its architects. That's why it's important to make note of Darrow's early days. He began his career as a corporate lawyer and made a pretty penny representing the people he would later call the men who rule the world. But his 1894 meeting with socialist activist and leader Eugene Victor Debs was transformative. Darrow resigned from his corporate clients and, at serious financial sacrifice, began representing those who opposed the economic elites. He represented Debs at a federal espionage trial 4 years later and lost. But Darrow, socialist, anti-racist, atheist, had begun his long walk as a rebel lawyer. He opposed the death penalty and represented 100 clients facing death and never had a single one go to death row. And speaking of the death penalty, I want you to know that this isn't my first trip to Yale. For in 1991, the Yale Law Journal published my essay called Teetering on the Brink Between Life and Death. It's in volume 100. One of my lawyers was exalted, saying, "I made law review." I calmly replied, "You're right." And I didn't take a class. I thank you for inviting me back and welcome the work to come to abolish mass incarceration. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And from Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimite non carborundum, excuse my Latin, and stay safe.